The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
Our very special guest on this episode is beloved author, educator, and social activist, Laureen Carey. She's the author of several books, including Black Ice, The Price of a Child, and Pride.
Laureen's most recent book is a memoir called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. It's received rave reviews, including one from O, the Oprah magazine, which called Lady Sitting simply radiant. Laureen, thank you so very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thank you.
You know, as a two-generational mother-daughter duo, Laura and I are always interested in multi-generational stories from other people's families. So tell us the story behind the book, Lady Sitting.
The story behind it is our year and a half, close to 2 years, of having my grandmother with us on hospice. She came to us from the hospital. We expected that she had somewhere between weeks and months to live. And then she got better, or as she said, "Oh, honey, you're treating me so well, I can't die." And she lived on with us. She hadn't wanted to come. She had lived up until 99 years old in her home and wanted to live there alone on her own terms, but just couldn't.
You said that she was terrified of death. And when you just said how she told you, "I can't die," I was just taken back to that to that moment, because it really hit me. I mean, so many of us are, and she was just facing it. So even though she didn't like to talk about it, what do you remember about that last conversation with her and if her view changed at all about death?
No. It's fascinating. I go back and forth with myself. I talk to my sister about this, because the fact is none of us knows what the other knows, for real, for real. But you do see the behavior. And Nana would say things, and then her behavior would contradict it. So what I saw... we had a conversation, I remember, where she said to me late at night, she had struggled to get out of the bed. She'd gotten her leg stuck in the side of the bed and had wet herself. "There's a child crying outside. Is that okay for your broadcast?"
"Oh, yeah, that's fine. That's fine." Oh, I didn't even hear it. No. I didn't either.
Okay. All right. I never know. I'm in a Philadelphia house and we're very close to the sidewalk. She'd gotten her leg stuck. She had wet the bed. I was changing it. She was washing herself. It was late, you know, early morning. And she said to me, she whispered, she said, "You want me dead, don't you? I know it." And, you know, she insisted on an answer. She was so, she just knew it. And it was as if she had in some way flushed me out like a pheasant. And I couldn't lie to her at that top of the morning. I wanted the end of the decline of the Nana I knew into this person who was so afraid of death that, in fact, she was sucking our entire family into the project of making sure she stayed alive, making sure that we pretended as if we didn't notice the care we were giving, as if everything was as it had been 20 years ago. And at the same time, we wanted to give that care. It was a total mashup of love and death and duty and responsibility. And I found myself just saying, appealing to her sense of courtesy by saying, "You are shouting, Nana, and the whole family is asleep." And she sort of swallowed her voice and said, "Oh, okay." Mm. And then as we went on, and I think for me, this is where the book started. She said, I know this sounds ridiculous for someone who's so close to death, but and I said to her, "You're wondering if we have a snack downstairs?" And she said, "Yes." And then she was particular about these little tarts that I would get at Whole Foods. And there was custard and there'd be fresh fruits on top, little kiwi. And she said, "Do we have any more of those little fancy things?" So I went downstairs and made us a low tea time for 3 a.m. And it was at that point that she asked me to steal into the cemetery where her father was buried and take her ashes and dig a hole with a spade and pour them in.
And what did you say?
I said no. She couldn't believe, like, what? Because this was an ongoing theme. You know, she asked, sometimes she would say, "Why am I still alive?" And I would say to her, "Because God wants you to have the opportunity for intimacy with someone who will tell you no." She did not think that was funny. She was just fit to be tied, as she would say. But I said, no, Nana, that's theft. You know, once in 101 years, a cemetery gets a chance to sell you something. You can't cheat them out of their one shot.
You know? Why did you decide to write the book? I mean, this obviously was just a very emotional time in your life. And I would think that when that chapter had ended, you know, you might want to be moving on to something else instead of reflecting on what that had been. So why did you decide to write about it?
You know, I didn't write about it for like 8 years. I hadn't planned to write about it. I wasn't, you know, taking notes for anti-mortem or, you know, post-mortem rather. Anti-mortem notes. I think I just found myself one day, very seldom, I don't do a lot of journaling. I do journal during periods where I'm having lots of dreams or I have a dry spell or I can't figure out my way through a project. And this, that evening snack came up. And, you know, so a lot of memories come up. I just wrote it, but I found myself going back to it and expanding on it and thinking about it. And for me, that's the sign that I need to write more. It may not be that I need to write a book, but that I need to write more. And I didn't understand well enough what had happened.
I think that for us to understand how significant and special Nana was, it would be great if you could read us a passage from the book and about your childhood and what she meant to you then and how your perception of her changed to when she was on her deathbed.
Sure. This is right from the beginning. Why was it that weekends at Nana Jackson's felt like a world apart? Maybe because dressed in old ball gowns, I traveled with the sun patch across the floor of the suburban New Jersey neocolonial and soaked in more light and luxe than my parents' West Philadelphia apartment could ever offer. Delight and time, the wide-armed, fragrant mimosa to climb in summer, the fireplace to stoke in winter, and choices all the day long, whatever your little heart desires. Yes, yes, yes. I knew I was being spoiled. That word that obsessed Black grown-ups and even kids. What could be worse than to be spoiled, ruined by indulgence, incapable of withstanding hardship as we had done and would do in future? We were brought up by hand as surely as Pip in Great Expectations, and much prouder of it than he. You spoil could get you a corrective beatdown fast. Besides, everybody needed to respect authority, learn limits, and above all, to know that older people valued you, that they loved your undeserving Black behind enough to bring you back from wrong to right. I knew myself to be a wimp, a failure in the toughness category, which was why I went insane with terror at the sound of my mother coming for me or my father reaching for the threatened, though seldom used, belt. If a kid down the street got a beating, and in our cheek-by-jowl row houses we heard each one, I'd be good for a month. So believe you me, as my mother would say after administering some firm guidance by hand, I knew good and well that my whole Nana deal was off the charts spoiling. One of my earliest memories with Nana at her house anchors the rest. I wanted a drink of water and went into the kitchen. Nana wasn't there, so I reached for a glass. They were small Libby juice glasses, diner style, wavy and thin enough to feel beautiful against my palm. I forget whether I climbed up to reach the metal cabinet that opened with a ping or found the glass on the counter. Either way, I knew it was too high for me. And as I knew it, the tiny tumbler dropped from my hand onto the linoleum where it crashed into sharp pieces. Fear flooded me from scalp to gut. My mother had warned me to behave well on these weekends. She sent just right outfits, perfectly laundered so I'd look like somebody cared. Now instead I'd shattered one of the thousand glass hazards in this breakable house with its bric-a-brac ceramic white faces and Chinese antique stuff everywhere, all things I was usually careful to look at but never touch. I'd get in trouble with mommy for failing to be careful, but what was worse though was that I'd broken the spell. I'd wrecked the charm of my magical place. Nana would be angry, and I would no longer be the trusted, free-range granddaughter, free to play records over and over and pick out tunes on the piano and dress up and sing and draw and make up stories. I could hear her rushing down the carpeted steps, my gut wrenched with dread. "Oh, honey," she asked when she stepped into the kitchen, "what happened?" I know I should admit the wrong and apologize. The metal cabinet pressed cold against my back. Nana looked back and forth, frowning, inspecting the scene like a diorama. She took my right hand, turned it over, and then smiled. "I thought you had cut yourself," she said, clearly relieved. "We can always get another glass, but we can never get a new hand, can we?" Sabbath returned, not a charm, but a piece we could choose. She never hit me.
And how did your perception of her change over the years?
Well, I think it's true for all of us that as we become adults, we have different relationships with our older people. We see their flaws in ways that we didn't. And then we grow into a new kind of love. I think it was very important for Nana to hold on to the perfect purity of the love a child has for an older person. Her own mother had died when she was 6. She always said she didn't remember her mother. And I think, she had one son, my dad. I think a little girl was someone whom she identified with and spoiled and just wanted to keep you a little girl. My parents divorced. I was very unhappy to see the way all the grown-ups chose sides. And particularly unhappy that she did not continue to be for my sister the kind of the Sabbath that she had been for me. She didn't come pick her up. She didn't figure out ways to do, as many of us do. I mean, my stepson and his wife divorced, and we just figured, you know, she's the mother of our grandchildren. Full stop. She will, you know, she calls myself, calls herself. She says, I'm your forever Texas daughter. He is. I mean, once you have the grandchildren, you are my forever daughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know what happened to him, but you are my daughter. But Nana wasn't able to do that. And I think our relationship definitely, I saw the limits of it. It was very hard for Nana to have grown-up intimacy.
I thought it was really interesting when you talked about Nana's relationship with your father and what that taught you about love. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
First thing I can share with you is that none of that was in the first draft.
Really?
Zero.
Wow.
None.
Why was that?
Because I didn't want to write about it.
Ah, that's a good reason.
That's it. And my editor, I didn't know how to. My editor said to me, the reader has some questions. She's a very, very delicate
background info.
You know, like, why are you taking care of your father's mother? Like, what's up? Why isn't your father in the story? It feels like he's, you know, moved to Montana, which he hadn't moved to Montana. He just lived in the same city as we did. What I learned from that was the terrible wound he had experienced from just what I'd said, from her lack of intimacy. They had had, she and her first husband, my dad's father, had had a horribly bitter divorce right at a time, those sort of those tween years, you know, when a boy is just growing, you know, had we been Jewish, that would have been bar mitzvah time, right? That's the rite of passage time.
Right.
It's so important for a kid. And she wasn't able to figure out how to co-parent. They weren't, the two of them were not able to figure out how to co-parent, how to put his needs above their own anger. And I'm afraid that, I mean, that's one of the things he learned from her, was that lack of intimacy. And yet they were absolutely in sync in other ways, right? So that later in the book, what you find out is, although I told Nana no about that whole putting the ashes, shoveling them in, you know, stealing into the cemetery at night as if we were going to climb the wrought iron fence for God's sake. What I found out was she had had the same conversation with Daddy.
Wow. And how did it go then?
He said, yes.
Wow.
He said, yes. He said to me, it was, we sat in a Dunkin' Donuts after she died. You know, you have to go to the cemetery has a cremation facility, and the next of kin has to sign to allow the body to be cremated. We're waiting for the people to come back. They were on lunch, and he and I had this coffee, and he said to me, now, I want to talk to you, honey. Now, this was this was my mother's dying wish. I said, oh, no, Daddy, no. No, I knew it was coming. No. But they were on the same wavelength in many ways that she and I never could be.
You write that a month after she died, Nana started coming to you in your dreams. Tell us about that.
I thought after she died that I would rest some. And as soon as I was sleeping full nights, I mean, I would see her so clearly in her wheelchair talking to me. I've had a lot of older people in my life die. I'd never had, and so, you know, you have dreams about them. Mm-hmm. But I'd never had a dream where that person comes back, looks me in the eye, and she was banging on the sides of her wheelchair saying, get me back into my house. Like, just do it. And it happened a few times so that I realized I had to talk back to her in order to get my subconscious back to my, take it back. Where I said to her, no, Nanny, you have to stay where you are. You have to stay where you are. And I found that, you know, the story has done many things. People have been interested in different ways. So I did I've started writing, I love to write libretti. And I wrote a libretto for a 30-minute mini opera with the American Lyric Theater in New York for this wonderful young composer, Lilia Ugai. And in it, you know, it was very much inspired by that, as Nana coming back as a ghost and telling me to rewrite the story, not to put in all of these questions. I mean, the libretto in the opera says, you know, how do we know what was love and what was show? And she comes back and is rifling through the papers saying, no, you need to take that out.
You know, our show is called Nobody Told Me. So at the end of each show, we ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? And obviously, this is a story filled with Nobody Told Me lessons. But I'm curious to know, what did she tell you about really the meaning of life and how you need to live your life to get to 101 and maybe learn those lessons that you learn at 101 when you're 31 that you'd like to pass on to the audience and hope that they get some benefit from?
Well, I hate to, gosh, when you put it like that, it seems so churlish not to answer something wonderful. She didn't tell me. She didn't like that. She hated. She said, I hate when people ask me the meaning of life. She said that they treat me like a freak. She didn't want to be thought different from herself as a younger person. She didn't feel different. She didn't feel more wise. She didn't feel she'd done anything special.
What did what message did you take from this experience with her, or just observing her and relating to her over these years?
I'll tell you what, all of the lessons and the meaning were translated instantly into my life with my children. That everything I learned from her, right and wrong, I had to, it was like a United Nations instant translation. You know, the moment mm-hmm. I spoke, momento que hablo, then I heard the translation. Entonces puedo oír trasladar, like instantly. So what I learned in that moment from her was that something we had heard from a therapist about teenage years with our children, which is, it is much more important to stay connected than to be right.
Oh, interesting. Oh my gosh, that's
powerful.
Powerful.
That's
yeah.
Very powerful. Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, the book is so powerful. And gosh, I mean, it's just beautiful. How can people find that and learn more about you and all of your work?
Thank you. It's called Lady Sitting. You can find more about it. You know, it's listed if you Google it, lots of places. My website has more information and ways to buy it, of course. And that's Lorene Carey, LoreneCary, Carey is a four-letter word, .com. There's no E in it. So you can find out all that about it. You can even find, I have a blog on Medium at Lorene Carey. It's my blog, which has a blog about the opera. You can find a wonderful recording on my YouTube channel, Lorene Carey One. So you can just Google Lorene Carey and all of it's there.
Well, Lorene, we thank you so very much. We've learned a lot from your story, and we really appreciate you sharing it because, as I say, I think it applies to so many people around the world. Just the relationship you had with her and the relationships we've all had with our elders.
Yeah. And I think she's really relatable as well when she talks about wanting to not be known for anything profound and not wanting to be known like a freak at 101, that she felt the same as she did when she was younger. I know my mom had told me that my grandma had said the same thing. So I think it's just interesting to get that perspective because we always think of older people as older people and they don't want to be thought of that way.
Right. Well, Lorene, like I say, we just really appreciate you sharing your family story with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This is a great inspiration for me too, because I'm working on a play about this. So you give me extra impetus. Thank you.
Oh, great. Great.
Wow. Well, wonderful.
And best of luck.
Thank you. Very much.
Again, our thanks to Lorene Carey, whose latest book is called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. And again, her website is lorenecarey.com. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.